Today is Thursday, May 6th, and you are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinua Adofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, U.S. warns the West against Chinese investments.
If it's investing in strategic industries, strategic assets, that's something that countries need to look at very carefully.
Plus, Australia offers haven to Myanmar nationals.
Many have said they fear persecution or arrest if they return home to a country scarred by weeks of civil unrest.
Also, the WHO marks World Hand Washing Day. These stories and more are next. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken said the West had to be cautious about the exact nature of Chinese investments in Western economies and think carefully about investments in strategic assets in an interview aired on Thursday. China's economic and military rise over the past 40 years is among the most significant geopolitical events of recent history, alongside the 1991 fall of the Soviet Union that ended the Cold War.
We're not trying to contain China. We're not trying to hold it back. We recognize that countries have relationships with China, interests with China. We're not trying to say you have to choose between China and the United States. But here's what we are saying. We're in favor of upholding certain basic ideas, and in particular, this so-called rules-based international system that we and the United Kingdom, among others, have heavily invested in for generations. We have to be very careful about exactly what the nature is of that investment. And if it's investing in strategic industries, strategic assets, that's something that countries need to look at very carefully. But that's one thing, and it's very important. Another thing is to say we're not doing any business. That's not what we're saying.
That's U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken. Staying on U.S. diplomacy, Blinken on Thursday pressed Russia to pull troops and end its, quote, aggressive, unquote, actions in Ukraine. He made the comments while on a visit to Kiev, in which he vowed to expand U.S. support. The top U.S. diplomat met Ukraine's leadership and toured a somber memorial with photographs of some of the more than 13,000 people who have died fighting pro-Russian separatists since 2014, when Moscow seized the Crimea Peninsula from Kiev. Russia last month amassed 100,000 troops near the border and in Crimea, its biggest buildup since 2014, but quickly announced a pullback in what many saw as a test for the new U.S. administration of President Joe Biden. But both Blinken and Zelensky said Thursday that the pullout had been limited. Hong Kong democracy activist Joshua Wong will face an additional 10 months in jail for participating in an unauthorized assembly on June 4th last year. Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters reports.
Hong Kong democracy activist Joshua Wong was sentenced on Thursday to a further 10 months in jail. Wong is guilty of taking part in an unauthorized vigil last year commemorating the 1989 Tiananmen Square crackdown. Last year saw the annual event on June the 4th cancelled for the first time in Hong Kong, with police citing the global health crisis. Still, tens of thousands of people lit candles across the city in what was largely a peaceful event. Judge Stanley Chan also sentenced Lester Shum, Janelle Long and Tiffany Yuan to between 4 and 6 months. A handful of activists gathered outside the court to protest the case. Chow Hang Tung is from the Hong Kong Alliance in support of patriotic democratic movements of China.
This is a charge for an unauthorized assembly, for a totally peaceful assembly confined to Victoria Park.
Wong is already serving time for other illegal assembly convictions relating to the 2019 protests. He also faces charges under the city's sweeping national security law, which was brought in last year. The legislation punishes anything China sees as subversion, secession, terrorism or collusion with foreign forces, with up to life in prison.
That's Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters. The Center for Disease Control is releasing projections showing the coronavirus pandemic toll in the U.S. will fall sharply by July's end. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Six research groups were tasked with predicting the pandemic's course between now and September under different scenarios, including the vaccination pace and how Americans behave. The results show mainly good news, that even with disappointing vaccination rates, cases, hospitalizations, and deaths would drop dramatically by July's end.
We are not out of the woods yet. but we could be very close.
Though CDC Chief Rochelle Walensky warns virus variants are a wild card that could set back progress, and she notes the researchers say hospitalizations and deaths could again jump if unvaccinated people do not follow basic precautions. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Student journalists across 23 campuses of California State University have played a crucial role in keeping other students informed during the coronavirus pandemic. VOA's Mike O'Sullivan reports the student newsrooms are now linked through an online newswire, pooling resources and sharing information across the expansive state.
With 485,000 students, this is the largest public university system in the United States. Since the start of the COVID pandemic and remote classes, students have been eager for news, especially news that affects California State University, or the CSU system. Student journalists provide it. Aidan McGloin is founder of the Cal State Newswire.
Whether that's Board of Trustees, whether that's campus presidents, whether that's student organizations, it's difficult for them to really see what's happening across the CSU, because yes, they can go online to each of the individual CSU student papers and try to find stories there.
But there was no single source, so while in his final year at California Polytechnic State University, San Luis Obispo, Aidan McGloin decided to share campus news, and with other Cal State students, created the Student Newswire. Student journalists meet in a chat room on the internet platform Slack and share stories through the self-publishing site Substack. The Student Newswire covered recent protests by Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders after a series of racially based attacks. Samantha Lowry is the visuals editor of the San Francisco State University Golden Gate Express.
Not everybody is in, you know, these major cities that are having these large protests. And with San Francisco, there's always something going on.
Students at Cal State Dominguez Hills in suburban Los Angeles cover events on and off campus. And when stories are of wider interest, they're shared.
That's VOA's Mike O'Sullivan. A U.S. security official tells VOA that forces carried out airstrikes against the Taliban in support of Afghan National Security Forces. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden shared the details with International Edition's Steve Miller.
Although Afghan officials have spoken out saying that these airstrikes are precision airstrikes, and they've told other media outlets that they're intense and heavy, and in some cases have been the only thing that have stopped Taliban forces from advancing on the city of Lashkargah in that province. So these are things that are ongoing. It is likely that there will be more airstrikes to come. The U.S. has said consistently, and the Pentagon reiterated today, that they will continue to do whatever they can as they withdraw for the U.S. military to support Afghan forces when they need it. Of course, the longer the withdrawal goes on and the more U.S. troops leave, the less likely it is that airstrikes like this will be able to be called in.
Did they mention about what kind of engagement U.S. forces were participating in? Are these drones? Are these aircraft? Because as you mentioned, U.S. forces are in that process of withdrawing from Afghanistan.
Our understanding is that these are aircraft that have been launched from Afghanistan and are carrying out these missions. U.S. officials, though, are not sharing very many details, because as these airstrikes are being carried out, you're seeing on social media how both the U.S. and the coalition are pulling forces back and are giving bases over, handing bases over, facilities over to the Afghan security forces. So they're not saying exactly what they are, precisely where they're coming from. But right now, that's our understanding of the situation, and that these strikes are being called in at the request of Afghan officials, who at the same time have been talking a lot and putting out a lot of propaganda, if you will, on social media about how well Afghan forces are doing on the ground, about how well the Afghan Air Force is doing in striking Taliban targets, in striking Al-Qaeda targets on the ground. Of course, some of this in areas where fighting is taking place, this simply cannot be verified. Taliban also are making numerous claims likewise in terms of some of the intense fighting we're seeing, not just in Helmand province, but also in Paktika and also other parts of the country.
That's VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden speaking with my colleague, Steve Miller. The recent guilty verdict in the trial of the officer who killed George Floyd came after months of street demonstrations and calls for greater police accountability. Police reform faces an uphill climb in Congress And as VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports, some worry it won't go nearly far enough.
Before the trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin began, the House of Representatives passed the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. It is now up to the Senate to act.
We should not mistake a guilty verdict in this case as evidence that the persistence problem of police misconduct has been solved, or that the divide between law enforcement and so many of the communities they serve has been bridged. It has not.
Schumer and other Democratic lawmakers call for policy changes in policing, such as repealing qualified immunity and creating a database of police officers and the complaints against them. Not going quite as far, Republican Senator Rick Scott, a vocal supporter of law enforcement, called for greater accountability on ABC's This Week.
I think you start with more transparency, and I think you bring in, you do what I've done, what I did as governor. You sit down with law enforcement and say, okay, so what can we do to be better, and why are some officers better, some departments better than others, rather than saying, oh, everybody is doing the wrong thing, and create an incentive for people not to do their job.
Greg Carr is chair of Afro-American Studies at Howard University in Washington. He calls for a total overhaul of policing in the United States.
We see, for example, what happened during the Floyd trial as another Minneapolis area person was killed by a police officer. That officer resigned from the force. Now, the question becomes, if they want to, do they show up in an adjacent police district with a new job? And so part of this national database will at least take away from local police departments the excuse, oh, we didn't know or we didn't check. No. And so I think it's incremental, this need to remake policing. We're not talking about reform. We're talking about remaking policing.
Police unions have resisted a national database and other reform efforts in support of their members. For now, however, the reform legislation is stalled in the evenly split Senate because of Republican opposition, and Chauvin, who is being held in a maximum security prison near Minneapolis, will be sentenced in June. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Facebook's recent decision about former President Donald Trump sends a signal toward leaders everywhere that to use social media, they have to play by a set of rules that are still forming. VOA's Tina Trent has more.
For world leaders and other VIPs who use Facebook and social media, the recent decision by the quasi-independent Facebook Oversight Board about former President Donald Trump is supposed to send a message. Dex Hunter Torek is the head of communications for the Facebook Oversight Board.
The same rules that apply to all Facebook users should also apply to influential users. Influential users should not be judged against a separate set of rules.
But the decision raises more questions about what exactly those rules are and what it means for world leaders who want to get their message out, putting a harsh spotlight again on tech's power over online speech. This week, the board, made up of journalists, activists, and lawyers, said that the social networking giant made the right call when it suspended Trump after the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol in January, but erred in making the ban indefinite. The board gave Facebook 6 months to make a final decision on Trump's account. Facebook said it would carefully review the board's recommendations.
Facebook had sort of punted the decision to the oversight board, putting Trump in an indefinite suspension and kind of leaving it to the oversight board to make the final call. But the oversight board is punting right back to Facebook and saying, no, this is on you. You need to clarify your policies and then decide whether this man meets them or not.
Emma Lonzo of the Center for Democracy and Technology said the board wrestled with the complex interplay between free speech and protecting people.
In an international human rights law, there is strong protection for freedom of expression for everyone, but there's also a recognition that some kinds of speech can actually lead to real-world violence.
There's been mixed reaction to the decision, with conservative lawmakers in the U.S. criticizing Facebook for keeping Trump off, and others saying he should have been permanently banned. Trump didn't address the decision, but criticized technology companies on his new site Wednesday. One thing that should change, the board said, is making exceptions for world leaders, whose postings, no matter how inaccurate or controversial, are deemed newsworthy because of their political standing. Now that the ball is back in Facebook's court, political leaders, influential people, and its 2.8 billion users worldwide will have to wait and see if the social network makes changes. Tina Trin, VOA News.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. In marking World Hand Hygiene Day, the World Health Organization is stressing the importance of good hand hygiene practices in stopping the spread of deadly infections. It says this is especially true at a time when the world is battling the coronavirus that causes COVID-19. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
COVID-19 has dramatically amplified the importance of hand washing. The head of WHO's Infection Prevention and Control, Benedetta Allegranzi, says this simple action can prevent the risk of transmitting the infection when used as part of a comprehensive package of public health measures.
Effective hand hygiene also prevents any infection acquired in healthcare, the spread of antimicrobial resistance, and other emerging health threats. Hand hygiene is a simple action that has a central role in contributing to quality care and to the whole of society efforts to prevent infection spread and saves lives.
A WHO survey of 88 countries finds low and middle income countries have made significantly lower progress than high income countries in implementing hand hygiene and infection prevention programs. The report notes one in four healthcare facilities in poorer countries does not have basic water services, and one in three lacks hand hygiene supplies. Allegranzi says the poorer countries lack the money needed to shore up their crumbling healthcare infrastructure. Consequently, she notes, most do not meet the minimal requirements to make a significant dent in reducing often life-threatening infections.
For example, in some low middle-income countries, only 1 in 10 health workers practices proper hand hygiene while caring for patients at high risk of healthcare-associated infections in intensive care units. While also in high-income countries, hand hygiene compliance rarely exceeds 60 to 70%.
WHO reports every year healthcare-acquired infections affect millions of patients and health workers globally. Europe alone, it says, records nearly 9 million infections yearly. The UN agency says highly effective and low-cost hand hygiene strategies are available that could reduce these infections by half. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Nigeria, state governors elected under the ruling All Progressives Congress say President Muhammad Buhari is committed to the fight against insecurity in the country amid growing criticism of his handling of several security challenges in different parts of the country. Within the past few weeks, armed militias have killed several security personnel, overrun military bases, and bandits have kidnapped dozens, including students, for ransom. The main opposition People's Democratic Party called for the president to resign, but officials say the demand is a ploy to incite the population against the administration. For more, I spoke with Ucho Nyagocha, political analyst and former federal lawmaker.
I think it's a major existential crisis for Nigeria because it's coming from every nook and cranny of the country. Every single state, including the Federal Capital Territory, is threatened by one arm of insurgency or violence or banditry or conflict between herdsmen and farmers and the other. So the situation is so bad that it's obvious that the security agencies are no longer able to manage it.
There appears to be little confidence in the ability of the government and the security agencies to manage these challenges. How did it get this bad?
I will give a socio-economic background to the crisis first and foremost. Since after the COVID lockdown, we know it as a fact that the economy of most countries are in tatters. The economy of Nigeria before the COVID lockdown was bad. Added to the COVID lockdown, one expected that there should have been some form of palliatives on the part of the Nigerian state. But instead of reeling out palliatives, there was an increase in electricity tariffs. There was also an increase in the price of petroleum products. So virtually everything had their prices increased, and the government was part and parcel of it, which meant that the government was so insensitive to the sovereign of the people. Most people who could not manage this situation, especially those who have a crime in claim, in such a situation, bound to take to the advantage that crime provides for them. So there is so much poverty in the land, there is so much unemployment in the land, there is so much frustration and depression added to the inability of the Nigerian state to manage the conflicts that are existing among the ethnic groups and also how much they have been biased in supporting one ethnic group over and above the rest of the country. This has all put the country on a very downward slide to violence. and the government has not in any way shown a capacity to manage the situation.
The government say the opposition has taken these issues and are using that as an advantage to push for the removal of President Muhammad Buhari.
No, I don't agree. That is a lame defense on the part of the government, because it is not the opposition that refused to create jobs. It is not the opposition that increased the electricity tariff. It is not the opposition that increased the price of petroleum products. All of this is added to the fact that the crisis in Central African Republic, in Chad, in Niger, in Mali, and most other West African countries, most of the people who are being displaced from these areas are also gradually migrating into Nigeria, and they are migrating with their arms, making here a safe haven for bandits and a place where insurgents could take advantage of the situation that is prevailing at the moment. So the government cannot run away by simply lifting its hands up and waving the white flag and blaming all of this on the opposition, because the president has failed in all its ramifications.
That's Uche Onyegocha, a political analyst and former federal lawmaker. He spoke with me from the capital city of Abuja. Australia is offering Myanmar nationals living there a safe haven. Canberra has said it will extend their temporary visas until it is safe for them to return home following February's military takeover. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Canberra has been under pressure to offer a haven to more than 3,300 Myanmar citizens in Australia. More than half of them are students, and their visas will be extended. Many have said they fear persecution or arrest if they return home to a country scarred by weeks of civil unrest after the military in Myanmar ousted the elected government of de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. However, it's not clear how long Australia will extend visas for, or how it will determine whether and when it's safe for Myanmar nationals to return home. Tozol Lat, the operations director for the Democratic Voice of Burma, a non-profit media organization, said he welcomes the decision to allow them to stay.
I think it is a right move for Australian government to extend visa. It's like in US, and you know, it's happened many places, especially overseas student visa is a grant extension. I strongly welcome this move, and they should do more to bring more people who needed asylum or more of their safe places, especially in Australia. I think this is in the right direction.
In Canberra, Immigration Minister Alex Hawke said in a statement that Australia continued to strongly urge the Myanmar security forces to exercise restraint and refrain from violence against civilians, release those detained arbitrarily, and engage in dialogue. Meanwhile, Australia's Home Affairs Department has launched an investigation into relatives of Myanmar's military living in Australia. There are concerns they are either harbouring assets taken from Myanmar or receiving financial support from the military in Myanmar following February's uprising. News reports have suggested that more than 20 family members of senior officials of Myanmar's new military government were living in Australia. Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy party won a landslide victory in an election in November with more than 80% of the vote. She was placed under house arrest in February following the military takeover. The Southeast Asian nation, also known as Burma, became independent from Britain in 1948. It was controlled by a harsh military government from 1962 to 2011. Australia has suspended military assistance to Myanmar and redirected aid to non-government organisations. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.